hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. These United Colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states. The words of the Declaration of Independence, presented on July 4th of 1776, provided a new vision for a new country, one that had its own ideas about governing, economics, and religious freedoms. And when it came to penning this declaration, choosing Thomas Jefferson was a no-brainer. Jefferson embodied the American ideals and American visions of our great patriots who fought for liberty in our American Revolution. He was a prolific writer and a man who had a great love for our country and everything it stood for.
We are trusted with the destinies of this solitary republic of the world, the only monument of human rights and the sole depository of the sacred fire of freedom and self-government. From hence it is to be lighted up in other regions of the earth, if other regions of the earth shall ever become susceptible of its benign influence. All mankind ought then, with us, to rejoice in its prosperous and sympathize in its adverse fortunes, as involving everything dear to man. And to what sacrifices of interest or convenience ought not these considerations to animate us? To what compromises of opinion and inclination to maintain harmony and union among ourselves, and to preserve from all danger this hallowed ark of human hope and happiness?
These are the words of Jefferson that we've all come to know, the Jefferson who served as president, vice president, minister to France, and founder of the University of Virginia, the Jefferson who penned famous documents from the Declaration of Independence to the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. But not as much is known about Jefferson the philosopher, Jefferson the essayist, and Jefferson the everyday man. Along with famous documents, Jefferson wrote over 20,000 letters to friends, colleagues, even to strangers. And through these letters, we learn about another Jefferson, who not only had opinions about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but of faith, simplicity, and the restraint of angriness.
Take things always by their smooth handle. Never be angry with anybody, nor speak harm of them. Anger only serves to torment ourselves, to divert others, and alienate their esteem. When angry, count 10 before you speak. If very angry, 100.
Today in The Exchange, we learn more about Thomas Jefferson through his writings. Our guest is Eric Peterson, a New York-based city planner by day who became a Jeffersonian in his free time. He went through the entirety of Jefferson's works, through tens of thousands of his writings, to compile Jefferson's thoughts into 34 essays in a new book called Light and Liberty: Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. Eric Peterson joins us now from a studio in New York, and we will not be taking your phone calls today in The Exchange. Eric Peterson, welcome. Great to have you.
Laura, thank you for having me.
What's the picture of Thomas Jefferson, Eric, that most of us hold, and how does a different picture emerge after you go through all of Jefferson's writings?
I think people regard Thomas Jefferson, of course, as one of America's great patriots and statesmen. They're familiar with his public contributions as president and author of the wonderful founding documents of our country that you mentioned. But in having the opportunity to go through all of his writings, he lived for a good long 83 years, and he kept copies, as you know, of virtually everything that he wrote, and he was a prolific writer and thinker. You get a sense of a person who was a really wise philosopher of life, if you will. They called him the Sage of Monticello during his sunset years after he retired from the presidency and moved down to Charlottesville. And so when you read his correspondence, you can sort of distill out the essence of a very positive philosophy of life, if you will, philosophy of the happiness of life, which is what he was all about, promoting happiness on a personal basis and also on a societal basis. And to sort of see his wonderful gems of wisdom scattered throughout all these wonderful letters that he wrote throughout his life really inspired me to sort of compile it together in a way that would be useful and interesting for people today.
And what struck you throughout this process, Eric? You know, were there themes that kept coming up again and again, or was there a way of writing or a way of thinking that really, that you found interesting or remarkable?
Well, to me, there are so many aspects of Jefferson that people are familiar with. I tended to focus on the wisdom of Thomas Jefferson, the insights that he had about the nature of life, the nature of human happiness, and particularly the practical aspect of Jefferson, how you could promote happiness on a personal basis and set up systems of society and government and agreed upon principles of relations with one another, both in our own country and internationally, that would promote the happiness that he felt that was the purpose of life. He said that the giver of life gave it for happiness and not for wretchedness. And his phrase, pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence, is one that we all identify with. And he spent his life searching for practical ways to reach the ideal of human happiness.
Could we talk about that a little bit more, Eric? Because this concept of happiness, you know, in an era where most people were literally scraping by day to day, you know, subject to all sorts of disease, was this concept of, you know, hey, we're born and we have the right to be happy, was that unusual or remarkable?
Well, the phrase life, liberty, and property was the standard Scottish Enlightenment phrase, which was in the air, in the intellectual air at the time. He took the notion that was being advanced by some others and actually worked it into that phraseology that we all appreciate and admire in the Declaration of Independence. There definitely was a lot of thinking about how best to organize society to promote human happiness. The founders of our country were real thinkers. They were well aware of the experiments in republican forms of government from ancient Greece and Rome. They were well aware of the Dark Ages and all the horrors that were associated with that. And they felt they had really a once-in-a-millennium opportunity to sort of set up a government, a republican form of government, a representative government that would promote the rights of man. And Jefferson was their key articulator, if you will, of the American vision. It's Jefferson's vision that we treasure about our country and what people around the world admire about America. It's the vision of freedom, the rights of man, self-government, equality, and the pursuit of happiness. And they knew that in America there was a special opportunity. When Jefferson went to France, when he was in the five-year run-up to the French Revolution, in 1789, he served as our minister to France. He took a four-month tour of that country, and he confirmed his worst fears, which were that 95% of the French people lived dirt-poor lives as powerless, kind of hopeless peasants, subject to the whims of the lord of the manor, if you will. And he said they had a fertile soil, a wonderful climate, great culture, and they were ground to powder by one single vice. And that was a bad form of government, a government that he called a government of kings, priests, and nobles. And so he fought all his life to establish practical structures of government which would allow the freedoms that he thought were God-given freedoms, which he thought once you could establish good forms of representative government that preserved the rights of man and allowed the freedoms that we were given to flourish, that prosperity would naturally follow. And obviously it has in the years since he set forth his vision here in our country and around the world.
You mentioned, Eric, his criticism of nobles, kings, and priests. And I was very struck in this book that you have put together, Light and Liberty, on his sharp criticism of priests and his strong belief that religion was a private matter. Let's hear what Jefferson said in one of his writings about the role of religion, and then we'll talk about it some more.
I have ever thought religion a concern purely between our God and our consciences, for which we were accountable to Him and not to the priests. I never told my own religion, nor scrutinized that of another. I never attempted to make a convert, nor wished to change another's creed. I have ever judged of the religion of others by their lives, for it is in our lives and not from our words that our religion must be read. By the same test, the world must judge me.
What strikes you about that, Eric?
Well, Jefferson's whole thrust of his philosophy was opposition to coercion. He felt that coercion was the worst possible form of the ways that humans could relate to one another. And his whole philosophy of liberty was one based on opposition to coerced views and coerced actions of your fellow man. Now, he had studied history, as I mentioned, extensively. And he observed that it was in the nature of things for groups of people to get together to form associations and attempt to coerce one another to their viewpoint, to their own belief systems. And he saw that those groups of people, I mentioned kings, priests, and nobles, government obviously representing kings, nobles perhaps the moneyed commercial classes, if you will, and priests representing various forms of organized religion, you know, various ways in which we all associate with each other in our daily lives. And he thought that the combined power of civil government and organized religion had produced some of the worst excesses in human history. And he asked this question, is uniformity attainable. In other words, can I coerce you to think the way I want you to think or act the way I want you to act? And he answers the question this way. Millions of innocent men, women, and children since the introduction of Christianity have been burnt, tortured, fined, and imprisoned, and yet we have not advanced one inch toward uniformity. So what he's saying is it's not really possible, no matter how hard we try, to ultimately to coerce one another to act and think the way we'd like someone else to act. And so he felt it was our freedoms were God-given. Essentially, they came from nature, and nature is God, as he expressed it in the Declaration of Independence, which you recounted. And so for him, religion was very much a personal matter. He might even use the phrase, you know, deep personal faith or spirituality. His happiness, his philosophy sprang from his heart as well as his mind. He definitely opposed the combined power of church and state. We all associate Jefferson with his famous phrase, the wall of separation between church and state, which the Supreme Court of our country actually embraced several years ago in interpreting the religious establishment clause in our federal constitution. He thought that you had to keep a good, solid wall between the two forms of human association. And I think people may not realize this, but he thought that was as necessary much for the protection of religion as it was for the protection of civil government, to sort of take power and scatter it and fracture it into as many segments as you can so that people would be free to live their individual lives without any form of organized coercion put upon them by either government or religion. But that wasn't to say that he didn't have a deep personal spiritual faith himself.
And he even wrote a book or compiled the sayings of Jesus at one point. So he did have a deep personal faith and interest in Jesus. You mentioned also, though, Eric, his interest and strong belief in good government and small government. What does Jefferson say on that score?
Jefferson really felt that to effectuate a happy society, it had to be decentralized, that you had to take power and fracture it and scatter it into as many shards and pieces as was absolutely possible. That's why he was a big proponent of our federal system of government. We have, you know, federal, state, and local. You have three branches of government. You have two houses of the legislature and so forth. Because his philosophy was you place under everyone's hand and eye what he may personally superintend, and only what each person can't handle themselves you turn over to the wards or the counties, and then to the states, and then to the federal government. So it was government from the individual up, not from the ruler down. I often say to my friends that we're fortunate in America to have had Thomas Jefferson because so much of the rest of the world had Napoleon or Napoleon's equal, meaning a government from the ruler down rather than from the individual up. And he based his philosophy of scattering power on this observation. He said, "I do not agree that 14 out of 15 people are rogues, but I do believe that rogues would be uppermost." In other words, the average person is not that much interested in self-aggrandizement. They were disinterested, if you will, but self-interested people, those interested in power and so forth and coercion, would tend to seek the highest offices, whether religious, corporate, or political, or any other institution that we may have. And it was for that reason that you had to take power and fracture and scatter it and so forth. I myself work, as you mentioned, with governments. I work with environmental projects. I'm an attorney negotiating contracts for large public works projects. And we have, in this country, it's taken for granted that we can have local governments sign major contracts for schools, roads, and water facilities and so forth, and issue bonds for that. Believe it or not, that is not the case throughout most of the rest of the world, even today, where the central government, as they call it around the world, tends to predominate even in local governmental decisions and thereby exercising a coercive role, if you will, from centralized power source.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guest in The Exchange is Eric Peterson. He has compiled Thomas Jefferson's words and essays in a book called Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. He joins us from New York City. We're not taking your phone calls today on The Exchange. Eric Peterson, one more question about this small government is the best government. Jefferson, though, was very proud of the fact that he expanded this country. He was responsible for the Louisiana Purchase. He sent out Lewis and Clark on their Western expeditions. Let's hear what Jefferson had to say about that, first of all.
I considered as a great public acquisition the commencement of a settlement on the western coast of America, and looked forward with gratification to the time when its descendants should have spread themselves through the whole length of that coast, covering it with free and independent Americans, unconnected with us but by the ties of blood and interest, and employing, like us, the rights of self-government. We should have such an empire for liberty, as she has never surveyed since the creation, and I am persuaded no constitution was ever before so well calculated as ours for extensive empire and self-government.
Now, Eric, how do you tie those two together? Because he surely must have known that as the country grew so big, it would have gotten more complicated.
Well, there again you have Jefferson, the idealist, and Jefferson, the practical man, and the man of action in government working to serve his country and people around the world. On the one hand, you have the notion that we should have essentially as weak a federal government as is possible to prevent descent into tyranny and coercion and so forth. But on the other hand, you had to have a strong central government as possible to protect the country and to from foreign competitors, if you will, foreign threats and challenges. So there was that balance, that practical balance, the need for a strong national government to be that empire of liberty, if you will, empire for liberty, and yet its power is not so extensive as to sort of tread on the basic principles of local self-government that he treasured so much. Now, when he looked at history, as I mentioned before, he saw experiments in representative self-government, you know, these local experiments, both mainly in Europe, both at the time of the Greek and Roman Empire and the late Middle Ages, being basically attempts to establish representative republican self-government to promote human happiness, but being crushed by larger outside forces. So his philosophy was to establish a practicable, workable model of freedom within which prosperity could flourish on a large scale so that it could not be crushed, as so many other experiments in liberty had been crushed in the past.
Well, Eric, you mentioned the word freedom, and we've got to spend a little time there because that's the principle that always comes up with Jefferson: freedom, freedom, freedom. And yet he owned slaves. What does he say in his writings about that?
Thomas Jefferson thought that slavery was fundamentally wrong. And yet here again you have the idealistic recognition of something that, you know, goes against every grain of his philosophy. And yet the practicality that it was so fundamentally embedded in the culture and reality of America, that there were real practicalities about kind of extracting yourself from the evil that really was slavery. So again, he tried to make the best he could of the situation, and he dealt with it on two levels. One, on a personal level, there's no instance of Jefferson ever mistreating his slaves. He had about 200 slaves throughout the course of his life alive at any one time. He inherited them. He didn't trade them. There was real concern there. He was concerned with preparing them for the day of their eventual freedom. And so he tried to teach them skills of carpentry, cuisine, chef skills, if you will, other skills that would allow people to be independent producers when the opportunity came. He did release three slaves. People may not know that. He released three of his slaves who had the skills, he thought, to survive in what was obviously a hostile world. And unfortunately, all three of them committed suicide, because they found the stresses of trying to cope outside the normal social norms of the time very, very difficult. So on a personal level, he had a very good personal relationship with those individual human beings that were his slaves. On a broader level, I'm not aware of any founding father who did more on a practical basis to try to ameliorate and roll back the conditions of the time. Again, your listeners may not know that he had three paragraphs in his original draft of the Declaration of Independence condemning the slave trade and the King of England for basically sponsoring the mercantilist slave trade. Those paragraphs were struck out of the final declaration at the behest of South Carolina and Georgia. He also wrote a law that was the precursor of the famous Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which was provisions governing how the new states in the Midwest were to come into the Union. And in that law, he wrote, after the year 1800, there shall neither be slavery nor involuntary servitude in the new states. And that law was defeated by one vote. This was 1783 when he was serving in Congress. And he said, in that awful moment, the fate of unborn millions was sealed. And then finally, when he was president in 1808, he signed the law that banned the importation of slaves, which was the first time you could sign it under the original Constitution. So he actually took concrete steps to try to ameliorate and roll back slavery. And on a personal level, he did the best he could for the people that he was charged with their responsibility for their lives. I would say this ultimately, that it's hard for us to imagine back then to a world of 3-mile-an-hour travel where people never ventured more than 30 miles from their home and where life was totally agrarian. But I do think that it would be a nice thing to do if people could start giving Thomas Jefferson some credit for the vision that he set forth. Ultimately of equality. That was his ultimate vision, not only liberty, but equality, oneness, respect for all peoples, you know, here and abroad. And it was that vision that grew into the freedoms that we have today. Thomas Jefferson's vision was embraced, obviously, by Abraham Lincoln, by Martin Luther King, and all those who worked after him to try to develop his vision. I think maybe the last thing we can say about it is that vision obviously takes time to manifest. We can't get to utopia overnight. And Thomas Jefferson set forth the vision which ultimately freed those who were enslaved at his time.
Are you saying, Eric, then, that perhaps there has been too much focus on the contradiction between his words and his personal ownership, that he's kind of gotten a bum rap, if you will?
I think most of the founders have. They were living in a society where it was an accepted fact. If you look at 35 years after Thomas Jefferson died, we had the Civil War. The Civil War is the most graphic possible demonstration of how deeply entrenched the institution of slavery was and how nobody was about to change it. It was a pipe dream to even think of changing the institution of slavery. The Southern states would not have signed the federal constitution in 1787, had there been any attempt by the northern states to restrict slavery. So it was an embedded institution that was not about to change at all. The Civil War, you know, we had 30 million people alive at that time in our country, and 600,000 died. If you apply that same ratio today, 300 million Americans, that'd be 6 million Americans dying today. And what was the issue? The issue was the expansion of slavery into the Western territories and the nature of our freedoms. And so that institution was so deeply entrenched, the ignorance was so pervasive, and people could not see a way out of it, that they fought a war with that degree of slaughter and bloodshed. And to think that Thomas Jefferson or anybody else during the time of the Revolutionary was about to change that, I think is fairly imaginative thinking.
Eric Peterson, he has put together a book called Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. It's a compilation of Thomas Jefferson's own words, essays on the American ideal. We'll have more with Eric and the writings of Thomas Jefferson when we come back after a short break. This is The Exchange from NHPR.
It's 9:30 on New Hampshire Public Radio. More of The Exchange, the words and wisdom of Thomas Jefferson, coming up.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're talking this hour about Thomas Jefferson with author Eric Peterson, whose book, Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness, takes tens of thousands of Jefferson's writing and puts them forth in 34 essays compiled by topic. From these essays and letters, you get a picture of Jefferson the person as well as the patriot and politician. This person, Jefferson, was struck by tragedy many times, including the death of his beloved wife and several children, his father at an early age, and yet Jefferson still repeatedly talks in his writings about the high importance of gratitude.
It is wise and well to be contented with the good things which the master of the feast places before us, and to be thankful for what we have, rather than thoughtful about what we have not. Lose no occasion of exercising your dispositions to be grateful, to be generous, to be charitable, to be humane, to be true, to be just, firm, orderly, and courageous. Consider every act of this kind as an exercise, which will strengthen your moral faculties and increase your worth.
Again, that's Thomas Jefferson, one of the essays from the book we're talking about today, Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. And Eric Peterson, talk about gratitude and how it is a thread woven into Thomas Jefferson's writings everywhere. I was very struck by that going through this book.
I'm so glad you focused on that particular topic, because that struck me about him. That was a facet of his philosophy of happiness that I really wasn't quite cognizant of. And the passage that you just read was interesting, because in piecing together Jefferson's thoughts in Light and Liberty, I had the occasion to sort of read letters written to his young daughters, as well as to famous, well-known statesmen and philosophers that he was friends with. And that passage that you just read combines succinct expressions of observations about the importance of gratitude written to his young 9-year-old daughter, as well as others written to people his own age as adults and senior citizens. So he had this consistent philosophy of happiness throughout his life. Gratitude was an important thread in his thinking. He really felt that life was a gift, a given by the Creator. His personal faith, as you mentioned before, it was very deep. It was very personal. It was arrived at by inner reflection and a lot of solid study. He felt that forgiveness, gratitude, humility, qualities like this were basic and fundamental as attitudes to have as you developed your own outlook on life and as you tried to sort of understand your own situation, improve your situation. There's chapters in here on self-improvement, self-perfection, and so forth. Gratitude was an essential element. You can see it in his first inaugural address, for example. It's brimming with references to how grateful our American citizenry should be for the wonderful lands that we have, the bounty of nature, the blessings of freedom and self-government, which very few people around the world had. And this is why I say that he was a man of the heart as well as of the mind. He was a brilliant thinker, obviously, but he had a faith that proceeded from his heart. He actually believed in the human soul. And he felt that America itself had a soul and that there was a kind of a spiritual foundation, if you will, to all the blessings and bounties that we have. And that inner conviction, that inner faith, was really the wellspring of his very positive philosophy of happiness.
And yet it's impressive because, again, his father died when he was 14. His beloved wife died after bearing 6 children, only 2 of whom survive. You know, this is a person who you wouldn't blame if he got kind of bitter and angry.
Well, he exchanged many, many letters, as people may know, with John Adams, who was his rival for a while, but basically his lifelong friend, philosophizing about these issues. They had shared many, many losses in their families together. At that time, as you know, death was everywhere. For example, in the city of Philadelphia, which is our nation's capital, in the 1790s, there were 2 yellow fever epidemics while he was serving there as Secretary of State and later as Vice President, one of which killed off about 1/5 of the population of the city of Philadelphia. It was about 25,000 people, and it killed off about 5,000 or something in that range. And so disease and pestilence and all sorts of unfortunate circumstances would affect people at that time in ways that we can't truly appreciate with all the blessings that we have today. And so you really had to develop a philosophy of life that would sustain you against all these hardships and tragedies. And he certainly did. As you mentioned, he lost 4 of his 6 children. He was only married to his wife for 10 years. They were married between his ages of 29 and 39. And his grief was so deep when his wife died after giving birth to their 6th child that he was inconsolable for weeks and months. And it was only his friends that brought him out of that and got him involved in public service to kind of restore his happiness. He believed that nothing makes me more happy than to render any service in my power of whatever description. And so he went back to his world of public service to try to restore his spirits. And eventually his spirits were restored and he regained that sense of optimism and confidence and hopefulness. There's a lot of material in this book on hopefulness, cheerfulness, and themes like this.
Right, optimism.
That really are fundamental to mm-hmm. having optimism, fundamental to having a good positive outlook. He was the original power of positive thinking. He was also a great opponent of fear. He said, how much pain have cost us the evils which have never happened? That was his way of saying, don't worry, be happy. he said, fear and desire are the 2 principal diseases of the human mind, and we need to conquer them in order to attain tranquility and happiness. So it's very much a personal, productive philosophy of happiness.
And it's an impressive portrait that emerges, again, from these essays and letters and writings that you've compiled, Eric. And yet I wonder, as you comb through thousands of documents or writings by Thomas Jefferson, did anything emerge about Jefferson that you found unattractive? You know, was he sort of holier than thou at some points? Or did you just read that and go, well, I don't agree with that at all?
Jefferson was not doctrinaire in his thinking at all. He didn't have a sense of superiority. You know, he said at one point, if I am conscious of one thing, that it is that I have no difference in feeling in writing to the highest or the lowest person on earth. He was very much a man of humility. That's one of the things that emerged from my reading of Jefferson. Humility is essentially a feeling neither superior nor inferior to anyone else. And so you can see this brilliant man, you know, with a vast heart and an illuminating soul, writing letters back to anyone who would write to him. He said he could not refuse to answer any letter that he ever got. And so many, many of the letters in the collection that I worked through in preparing Light and Liberty were letters written to strangers who had simply heard about him and knew he was interested in agriculture or this or that element of public policy, and they would write to him, and he would write back and respond at length in many cases to complete strangers. So here he is feeling that he had a duty to serve and to interact and on a humble basis, if you will, feeling neither superior nor inferior. And he acted that way in the public service as well. When you look at his foreign policy views, for example, he really felt that we needed to restrain ourselves from any kind of sense of superiority or lording it over others when we were to attain a position of power, as England and France had attained in his day. So humility was very much important to him. Again, it all comes from his sense of basically egalitarianism. That was what he was all about.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned his, as you put it, humility in public policy and foreign relations. We have another reading that I want to play now where Thomas Jefferson describes his philosophy on war.
If there be one principle more deeply rooted than any other in the mind of every American, it is that we should have nothing to do with conquest. The energies of the nation, as depends on me, shall be reserved for improvement of the condition of man, not wasted in his destruction. The lamentable resource of war is not authorized for evils of imagination, but for those actual injuries only, which would be more destructive of our well-being than war itself. Peace, justice, and liberal intercourse with all the nations of the world will, I hope, with all nations, characterize this commonwealth. Friendly nations always negotiate in private. I hope our wisdom will grow with our power and teach us that the less we use our power, the greater it will be.
Again, stemming from his belief that France and England were colonial powers, that was not a good thing, Eric. And yet, as white Americans expanded westward, they, in a way, colonized Native American populations and killed, you know, thousands and possibly millions of people.
That's always similar to the issue of slavery, the issue of the Western expansion, you know, and the impact of that on the Indian populations is always a dilemma that naturally, you know, intrigues people about how could this be. Again, I would say that you're dealing with a very practical man. A man of very high ideals. He was not an armchair philosopher who was not active in the world. He did have a clear set of ideals and beliefs about the betterment of mankind and basic principles that he thought we should all adhere to that constituted his vision. But here he was in a society that was, you know, saddled with slavery, with a population that was kind of itching at the seams to kind of burst out and go westward. You had other imperial nations, Spain, England, France, and so forth, vying for power on the North American continent. And he basically saw a westward sweep of population that was going to overwhelm the Indian nations no matter what happened. No one could prevent that from happening. That was a fact of life, just like slavery was a fact of life. So you're living in that society, and what do? You ameliorate it as best you can. One of the stories that I like best is, in terms of his attitudes toward Indians, is when he acquired the middle third of the United States, as you recall, through the Louisiana Purchase 2 and 2 years ago. He bought it rather than conquered it, if you will. He didn't have a war with France or Spain to get it. He bought it, which is essentially an act of peace vis-a-vis the countries who claimed sovereignty over that middle third of the United States. And then the next year, 1804, he sent out Lewis and Clark to the West Coast to establish an American claim, if you will, to the western third of the United States. So it really is Thomas Jefferson who is responsible for trying to create a continental empire for liberty, as he called it. Now, in that territory, you have all of these ancient Indian tribes, and what do? You know they're going to get overwhelmed by a westward-moving populace no matter what you do, so you make the best of it. What he did is he sent Lewis and Clark out there. People may not know this story as well. They had with them a bronze medal, a fairly heavy-duty medal. On one side, it had the picture of Thomas Jefferson, President U.S., 1803. And then the other side, it had a tomahawk overlaying with a peace pipe and the words peace and friendship, reflecting Thomas Jefferson's ideal philosophy that peace and friendship with all mankind is our wisest policy. And he had Lewis and Clark give these medals, these Indian peace medals, to all the chiefs that they met. Again, here's the practical side of Jefferson. Lewis and Clark was a military expedition. And yet, their charge, as he gave it to them in their address to Congress and the instructions to Lewis and Clark, there were about 30 members of the party, were focused on scientific exploration and trying to establish a friendly relationship with any of the Indian tribes that they might meet on the way. And of course, he didn't really know what was out west. It was all unexplored territory at that point. So there's a concrete example of Thomas Jefferson trying to take the practicalities of the situation and make the best of it toward in the service of his ideals of peace and friendship internationally.
Now, Eric, sometimes historians hate this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. You get so involved in the man's writings and his life and his thoughts. What do you think he would be most encouraged by and most discouraged by if he were plunked down into, 21st century America?
Well, I do think that he would be encouraged by the rolling out, if you will, of his vision in this country and internationally. He felt that if you could establish an agreement among people in society to adhere to the basic principles of his vision, the vision I recounted earlier of freedom and self-government, rights of man and so forth, equality, pursuit of happiness, if you could establish a societal consensus on that, prosperity would naturally flow. And of course, we have prosperity in this country beyond anybody's wildest dreams at that time. And he would say that that's a natural consequence of freedom and self-government. But I chose the title of Light and Liberty for this book because one of the things I learned in studying Thomas Jefferson's life and writings was his philosophy that light is of equal importance with liberty. He basically said at one point, no light, no liberty. That they go hand in hand. Light and liberty go together was his phrase. Now, what did he mean by light? According to Jefferson, light is freedom from ignorance. He said, if a nation expects to be both ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. And so what did he mean by ignorance? He meant an excessive focus on those things which divide us and separate us, our differences, rather than what we have in common, rather than focus on the common good, a sense of oneness with other people. So he said, if that's ignorance, and if you have too much of that, you really can't have liberty. So how do you overcome that ignorance? According to Jefferson, it was through education, science. It was learning was called science at that time, through what he called a diffusion of knowledge. Now, in the 1770s, after he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he went back to Virginia, which he thought were the place he thought the action really was, and he wrote a whole series of laws, including the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which you mentioned earlier, a very important accomplishment for him. But he also wrote other laws that were intended to sort of advance and better humankind, one of which was a bill a law called a Bill for the More General Diffusion of Knowledge, in his wonderful, eloquent expression. It called for a public, the public to fund education for youngsters in the first, second, and third grade, public expense, elementary education for three grades. It was a totally radical idea at the time. And basically, it never passed for 50 years.
Uh-huh.
But he thought that education was necessary to overcome ignorance, and he felt there was a slow, gradual process. And so he would be encouraged by the process of the enlightenment of mankind through education.
Our system of public education, our university system, and so forth.
Right. But also, you asked about what he'd be discouraged by. And there's a direct tie in there to the issue of light, because he was sure that if a society didn't have enough light, they wouldn't want to try to attain self-government and liberties, and it was folly, really, to sort of assume that they could. So if he were looking around the world today, I think he'd be a little bit disturbed by what he would probably call our unrealistic, perhaps even utopian thinking, that you can actually push a society to advance in the realm of light or enlightenment that's necessary to obtain and secure liberties faster than they're willing and able to go themselves. One of his famous statements is, "Enlighten the people generally, and tyranny and oppression of body and mind will vanish like evil spirits at the dawn of day." So that's what people around the world are trying to do, but you can't push them too quickly. And if you do, he said, if people attain liberty too quickly, whether it's given to them, forced upon them, or however it is, they simply won't value it. They won't value, as he put it, self-government above all other blessings, and it'll revert to some form of tyranny. But eventually, he was ultimately optimistic. He thought the world would eventually succeed in achieving, on a practical basis, the vision that he set out.
So provide the inspiration and the words and the model, but beyond that, don't get involved?
Yes, because he said his basic philosophy was that every man and every body of men possesses the right of self-government. Essentially, again, it's a right given by nature, or nature's God, and so forth. So I govern myself, you govern yourself, my nation governs itself, your nation governs itself. And if you trespass upon that right of a people or a nation to govern itself, you're basically violating fundamental rights. And it's impractical anyway, because you can't coerce others, as I said earlier, into thinking or acting the way you want them to act. And so, yes, he would say, he would be enthusiastic about what he sees around the world as movement toward self-government and the rights of man and equalities and so forth. But I think he would be a little bit upset of the lack of humility, you might say, with which our country is going about it, and some of the obvious examples that we're all familiar with.
What would you ask Thomas Jefferson if you could sit down with him, Eric?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I would talk to him about perhaps a little bit more about his personal philosophies. He was, as I mentioned, there was a distinct dichotomy between his public expressions, which were all idealistic, articulating our nation's ideals, fundamental truths over and over again as he saw it, and the actions that were accompanied by that as he tried to live it on a practical basis. But he kept his views of his life philosophy, his personal life philosophy, what he was interested in, very much to himself. You see them in his letters, but he never really talked openly about the personal side of life as a public figure, because he thought they were two totally separate realms. And so I would love to have been his friend in that era. And I would have loved to have shared, you know, views on, how he thought we should, you know, advance ourselves and improve ourselves in life. And you can see hints of this philosophy, you know, in his letters. He was a great outdoorsman, for example. He loved being outdoors. He spent every possible minute outside. He loved nature. He said that the sun never caught him in bed for 50 years. That's how enthusiastic he was to get up every morning. He said, "There's not a sprig of grass that springs uninteresting to me, nor anything that moves." So he's very inquisitive. He loved observing nature. He recorded practically everything he saw. He recorded the weather every day. He recorded how his garden unfolded. He grew 175 varieties of vegetables at Monticello. He was a great architect. He was a fine musician. He was a violinist. They called it fiddling at the time. And even as a collegian, he played in the governor's weekly palace ensembles in colonial Williamsburg. And everywhere he went, he carried with him a little miniature violin that he called a kit. And he practiced his music in the in the corners of taverns on his way as he traveled. So he's very much a very disciplined individual who believed in hard work. He studied for 14 hours a day when he was a student, and as a college student as well as a law student. And he practiced his music constantly. He wrote letters for 4 hours a day. He mastered seven languages. He was interested basically in everything.
Doesn't leave a lot of time for sleeping, Eric.
Not much time for sleep. As a matter of fact, he said, I never go to bed at night, even before he got the little sleep that he got.
This is before the invention of electricity, too.
Right. I never go to bed at night without an hour or half hour's reading of something moral whereon to ruminate in the intervals of sleep. So this book, Light and Liberty, hopefully would have pleased him because it is a compilation, essentially, of his moral philosophy.
Well, where does this philosophy come from that you've laid out, Eric? You know, this optimism, this faith, this strong belief in doing the right thing. You know, where did Jefferson get that?
Well, a lot of his biographers have tried to determine where his philosophy came from, and many will point to the writings of others during his day. Novel writers of political philosophy, legal writers, and so forth. And certainly there were influences there, and some of the phraseology that you see in Jefferson's writings, you know, comes from that. But personally, I think there's a much deeper source. He said, every man's reason should be his own oracle. He very much believed in the human conscience. He said the conscience is the only sure clue which will guide us free and clear of all doubts and inconsistencies. And so this is one reason I would have loved to have been his friend and to have, you know, chatted with him on the hillsides down there in Virginia about his outlook and where it came from. I think it came from a deep personal reflection. It came from an inner sense, intellectual curiosity, yes, but I think even more fundamentally than that, it came from an inner sense, an identification of nature and nature's processes, and a deep personal faith that he had. His faith can be summed up in this way. He said, faith and works will show their worth by their weight in the scales of eternal justice before God's tribunal. So he felt that basically from within ourselves, that our creator, our maker, if you will, had given us all the tools that we need to reflect and develop our personal life philosophy. And he thought it was incumbent upon everybody to develop their own personal life philosophy. And it sure would have been nice to sort of have had a chance to share with him directly and personally at that time. But I think in the clues that he's left behind in his writings, you can get a good sense of what it must have been like to know him and what a positive experience that must have been.
What's your favorite Thomas Jefferson quote, Eric? I know you've looked at a lot of them.
There's a lot of them there. How about this one? I shall pursue in silence the path of right.
What does that mean to you?
Well, it basically involves his philosophy of not getting involved in anything that smacks of coercion, to not try to force others to act or think in some particular way. So by silence, I think he was a big believer in silence. If you go down to his home in Monticello in Charlottesville, it's a very majestic location on a mountaintop with beautiful views of the Blue Ridge Mountains. It's almost like a semi-heavenly scene, if you will. You can imagine him getting up at the crack of dawn and so forth, enthusiastic to start the day and greet nature and its blossoming beauty and bounty. And hovering over all that is a beautiful sense of silence. And he felt that you had to get away from the noise of the world and the noise of conflict and go within and determine your life philosophy from within yourself. And then once you do that, to try to follow your conscience and try to do the right thing. And as I said before, his belief was that faith and works will show their worth as you live your life from the dictates of your own conscience, not trying to coerce or force others or dominate or interfere with or meddle with other people's lives.
Well, Eric, it's really been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Laura, thank you. It's been a delight on my part, too.
Eric Peterson, he's editor of a new book called Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. It's a compilation of the essays and writings and letters of Thomas Jefferson. For more information on The Exchange, go to our website at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio, produced by Ty Fraley and Rebecca Kaufman. Dan Colgan is our engineer. Our interns are Amy Hull, Ashley Johnson, and Josh Mackinoff. Special thanks today to our Jefferson reader, John Walters. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Knight.